It's the 16th of December 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a radio program and podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. If the Higgs boson could talk, would it say, "Stop calling me the God Particle"? Why does Comic Sans inspire so much hate? Is it because it shot the Serif? Who'd have thought that a bunch of beardy people sitting in a field would have some irrational beliefs? Is Sesame Street brainwashing our kids, or is Elmo a kind and benevolent leader? And have we now got enough science into theatres to confidently refer to such shows as a theory? But first, a big thank you to everyone who responded to our appeal last week. As you may remember, I told you about our deputy editor, Liz Luckendorf, who has unfortunately lost her job. So we asked you to support Liz in this challenging time, as well as help ensure the financial security of the Pod Delusion itself. As you might expect, the situation hasn't quite resolved itself yet, but she's got lots of promising leads to follow, and it'd still be great if you could support us. If you do enjoy the Pod Delusion, why not head over to poddelusion.co.uk and make a one-off donation, or subscribe to donate monthly. If everyone who listened donated a fiver, we'd be able to do the Pod Delusion full-time and make all sorts of huge improvements to the programme itself and to our website. You can find out more at poddelusion.co.uk. But anyway, now for a trademark awkward segue. The big news this week, or rather the really, really small news, was that there were some hints coming out of the Large Hadron Collider that they finally found the Higgs boson. On Tuesday, they held a big seminar to announce some preliminary results. But annoyingly for viewers of the live webstream, they spoke in a dialect of English known as physics. So in this first report, Kash Farouk has been speaking to John Butterworth, who works on the LHC, to put the findings into words that even someone like me can understand.
Even if you aren't that interested in physics, you've probably still heard of the Higgs boson and the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider. The term Higgs boson has even been trending on Twitter this week. This hypothetical particle, first proposed in the 1960s and named after Peter Higgs, is quite famous, especially considering that we don't even know if it exists. This week, a well-publicised seminar was held at CERN to discuss the latest Higgs search results from some of the particle detector experiments at the LHC. I spoke to Professor Jonathan Butterworth straight after the seminar. I know you've explained this hundreds of times, but can you provide a brief summary describing what the Higgs is and why it's important?
Sure. The standard model of particle physics is what we think explains. It's the best explanation we have of fundamental physics, the forces of nature and the particles that we're all made up of. But the only way that we can make it work is to introduce this thing called the Higgs field, which fills the universe and it kind of sticks to particles and it gives them mass. If you don't do the mass that way, then the theory kind of breaks. So this Higgs field is kind of important. And the only way of seeing whether the Higgs field is there, really, and seeing whether this is a correct postulate, if you like, is to excite little waves in it. And those little waves are basically the Higgs boson.
Okay. And can you explain how physicists at CERN are looking for the Higgs? What sort of experiments are going on? What you're working on, for example?
Yeah, so we collide particles with each other, protons with each other, at really, really high energies. And because E equals MC squared, and C squared is a big number, if you want to make a particle with a big mass, you need a lot of energy. And we think the Higgs, if it's there, we know the Higgs is between about 115 GeV and, say, 600 GeV, or before we started doing the experiments, that's what we knew. So we've got plenty of energy to create it. And then what we do is when it's created, it will decay very quickly, but we know it decays to other particles, and we know which particles it should decay to. And we look for those in our detector.
Okay, so you've just come out of a two-hour seminar. In your latest Guardian article, you wrote that this seminar could change physics forever. On the other hand, it might not. So now that it's over, what has it done?
Well, it hasn't definitively changed it, but it's changed my view of physics a lot. Whether that will be forever, we'll see. Because what's happened is there are hints that there's something going on, that there is a Higgs boson there. If there was really no Higgs boson at all, then you might have expected we'd have ruled it out. So in a way, that would have been the most changing thing. It might have been that we'd have ruled out the Higgs boson today. We didn't. And the corollary of that is that there's an increased chance that it's actually there. So I've always said, when asked, do you think there's a Higgs? I've always said, 50-50, we have to wait for the data. Now I would say probably yes, but it's a long way from 100%.
Okay. I was trying to follow along with the webcast. There seems to be, it was quite a lot of demand, so it wasn't streaming very well.
No.
But, so there's been two sets of results, one from Atlas and one from CMS, and both sort of suggest the existence about 125 giga electron volts.
Mm-hmm.
So what are the confidence levels?
Well, the Atlas one, I'm trying to remember now, the Atlas one is about 2.3 sigma, and the CMS one's only about 0.6 sigma. If you don't give them any credit for being at all correlated to each other or anything. So it's unlikely to be above the kind of 3 sigma that we would formally, even if you combine them, it's unlikely to be above the 3 sigma you would formally say was evidence, if you like, that you might publish in a paper as evidence. It's difficult to say what it would be if you combine them, because there are various correlations and things between the experiments, some of which can enhance the combination and some of it which would reduce its significance. So it's a bit hand-wavy, but neither of them are individually above this 3 sigma. The CMS one is really rather low. On the other hand, they're in this suggestive region where we think the Higgs is, if it's around. So it's, as I say, it's a shift of the probability, but it's very far from decisive, and it's not even yet formally something you would publish as evidence, I think, although it's so close that might happen very soon.
Yeah, so what does need to happen next?
Well, Atlas have not analysed all the data yet, although CMS actually had. CMS have looked at it in a really wide range of channels. But Atlas have only looked at it in a few of the channels, the most sensitive ones. But there'll be something to gain from Atlas looking at the rest of the data. And you might combine the two. But actually, the main thing that happens is that the LHC fires up again early next year, probably with a slightly increased energy as well. And we kind of repeat the experiment with even more data. And if we get similar answers again, then you start saying, yep, it looks like we have a Higgs candidate here.
Okay, I was reading Sean Carroll's blog about this, and he said many 3 sigma findings eventually go away. So I guess we can't get too excited anyway. We just have to be patient.
That's certainly true, although there is this thing called the look elsewhere effect, which is the difference between the odds of someone said this on Twitter today, it might have been Sean actually, it was very good, the odds of someone winning the lottery compared to you winning the lottery yourself are very different. Now, you've got to bear in mind that this is not a random 3 sigma effect in any old distribution. It's in the one that we knew where to look. So you might give it a bit more chance of sticking around than the many 3 sigmas. If you do 1,000 measurements, you'll get loads of 3 sigma effects, all of which will be nonsense. But this is like almost the one measurement we were set up to do first. So the fact that it's showing hints is a little more serious than it would be if it was some random other distribution that we were looking at.
Right, yeah, I get you. So you mentioned it already. If further experiment and analysis didn't find the Higgs, that would still be a major discovery. Can you sort of explain why that is the case?
Well, it would mean the standard model of physics doesn't work at LHC energies, basically. The only way it can be consistent at the energies we're colliding at now is if the Higgs boson exists. That's the standard model says it does, and you can't just say, oh, we didn't find the Higgs, maybe we didn't have enough energy, let's push it up to higher mass, because then it breaks the standard model. So it's not like if you're looking for supersymmetry or something, you could just say, well, you didn't find it, but it doesn't prove it wrong, because it could be just at higher energies. But with the standard model Higgs, we know where it is, and if it's not there, then the standard model is wrong and we need a better theory.
Okay, and even without the Higgs, the sort of technologies developed at CERN to look for it have been hugely important. So can you highlight a few such developments and inventions?
It's weird, because CERN is such a kind of bubbling hot pot of technological ideas. I mean, things that have come out of here in the past have been things like the World Wide Web, and the first touchscreen displays were in a control room at CERN. For the LHC specifically, I think the main benefit has probably been that we've got the biggest single cryogenic superconducting system in the world. So the industrialization of superconducting technology has really been advanced through the project to build the Large Hadron Collider. So I think that's one I would point to there. Things like the superconducting cable, it's called Rutherford cable. It was invented at the Rutherford Appleton Lab in Oxfordshire, but it's part of the CERN project. That's one of the big things that's used all around the world now for any superconducting system, any cryogenic superconducting system. So I guess that's probably the one I would pick out that's specifically the LHC, although, of course, we're making use of things like the World Wide Web and stuff, and the computing grid, the worldwide computing grid, all of which are feeding into this kind of technological advance.
Okay, finally, I'm going to end with a jokey question, which I reserve the right to edit out if it doesn't work. So what would you rather see, Manchester City to win the league title this season or CERN to find the Higgs?
Ah, tricky one. Now that we've seen hints of the Higgs, I'm afraid I have to betray Man City and go for the Higgs on that one. If it was 50-50, then I would have still said, well, actually, it would be more exciting to not find the Higgs. So I'll take Man City and no Higgs. But now that we've seen these hints, I'm buying into the Higgs idea a bit more than I was maybe. I'll probably regret that later.
All right. Okay, John Butterworth, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Cash. It's a pleasure.
The CERN seminar ended with the following quote. We haven't found it. We haven't excluded it. Stay tuned for next year. This is Cash Farouk for The Pod Delusion.
So I can't say if this news changes our view of physics, but it certainly changed my view of physicists. So it turns out that the LHC physicists, who are some of the greatest minds in the world today, use Comic Sans on their presentations. And not only that, they use animated clip art. I wasn't quite sure how to process this information, and neither was Twitter. I think Comic Sans was trending, and all I saw on Twitter wasn't about the results, but was everyone moaning about the Comic Sans. So I thought the best person to talk to might be Vincent Conair, the man who designed Comic Sans for Microsoft way back in 1994. I started by asking him to talk us through why the controversial font was developed.
Yes, it was 1994, and when I talk about this, I always want to bring people back to what it was like in 1994. It wasn't today, so you're talking about very binary screens. Things were on and off and pixels. You didn't have anti-aliased text, so applications were drawn like that. And we had an application that was coming out called Microsoft Bob, and I was handed that application on a CD and said, what do you think of the typography? It had cartoon characters and cartoon backgrounds with speech bubbles in Times New Roman. And I said, well, the typography is Times New Roman. It's a system font. It would be better if it was like a comic book, the way you drew the rest of it. And that's how it was created. It didn't get in that application, but there were other applications. One called 3D Movie Maker was the one that was released. It was made for the screen for that application. It wasn't intended to be printed. And so it was done with code, hinted for the screen, and made to be similar to casual writing, you know, comic style writing. We were doing a lot of fonts for the consumer division, which was selling products to home users, which were new users that when Windows 95 was going to ship, there was going to be lots of people that were going to have the computers in their home, which before that didn't happen. So we were targeting moms, dads, kids, families, not guys in suits.
So did you ever expect that Comic Sans would become so widely used?
No, you couldn't see that far ahead. If I could, I would have patented or something. But I couldn't. And there were lots of typefaces, or if you want to call them typefaces, designs like this at the time. And they were, because we had software now that we could just draw anything. You could scan. But people were designing fonts like cows and snow and just anything. And it was all kinds of crazy things that weren't traditional typefaces.
What do you think it was about Comic Sans that made it stand out from all of these competing fonts, if I can phrase it in such a way?
The first example of it I saw was that Microsoft, all the admins, we called them, the people that ran the company, really, were using Comic Sans for the emails. And we had a problem with an update. And I only found this out because we had a bug in one of our bits of software. And the new version of Windows was very strict on how it was using the tables and the fonts, and found that a lot of the fonts that we produced at that time had a bug in them, and they would carriage return after every character. So now when they installed the beta versions of the software, their emails became one character lines. So we found bugs with it. And so then I realized these were the admins. These were young women, mostly, that were choosing this font over anything else. So they were the target, really. They were the kind of people we would have targeted this font at. So I guess that was the first example I can think of that use.
When you see something in Comic Sans, a restaurant menu or something, do you still get that feeling of, I invented that?
I used to say, this is ridiculous, you know, silly and really wrong, like most of the people that say that. But now I laugh at it because it shows that anybody can print anything now. it's not professional publishing anymore. It's people making decisions on their computer and then sending it out to a printer or having a job done in it. One of the best was in Spain, in Valencia. Their largest theater had a play with one of the most famous actors in Spain. And all the signages in kind of Comic Sans, all the flyers, it was all over the city. And all I could think of, you know, what was that meeting like when they decided to make these posters? You know, they had to think about it.
What's the most inappropriate use of the font that you've seen?
Recently, I'd say during the swine flu epidemic in Berlin, I was going through the airport and they had the H1N1 virus warnings. The pamphlet was written in, I don't remember, Times or something. The sticker on top of it said H1N1 in Comic Sans. And I thought, that's a bit odd. But it was done again by a person at a computer typing it out and printing just some labels off.
Moving on a little bit, and I feel a bit awkward to mention this, but I'm sure you've noticed there's been a bit of a backlash against Comic Sans by the internet community. What do you make of this? I mean, I don't know how serious these people are being.
Well, I think last night at the Hammersmith Apollo, the Uncaged Monkey show, when Brian Cox said that I was in the audience, half the people booed and the other half did cheer. It was pretty 50-50, and that's about right. So you're going to have the people, there are people, I meet people all the time, and they say to me, it's my favorite font. I had a guy who used to pitch professional baseball in America. First time I ever met him, he said, I got to shake your hand. I can't believe I'm meeting the man that made my favorite font. So there are people out there that say they love it. But there is a vocal group that are purists and think that everything should be Swiss and it should be formal and it should be beautiful typography. But we don't sell everything like that.
I guess just sort of, you know, rounding off, because I don't want our audience to think that you're, you know, just Mr. Comic Sans. I mean, you've developed tons of other fonts as well. I mean, am I right in thinking that you also designed Trebuchet?
Yeah, I designed Trebuchet. I do a lot of the coding side of fonts. I don't design fonts as much. I'm not a full-time type designer. I have designed some type. I've designed the lettering that's in the Ministry of Sound logo. I've designed a typeface called Magpie, which is released by Dalton Mogg in London. My job is to be sort of a bridge between software engineer and designer. And that's what it's always been. I did the coding in for a font called Marlet that's in Windows, and that was a very technical job. It was to get all the pieces of all the icons to work together so that we could scale the user interface. So that's my job. Actually, my title now is, I think it's something like font engineer. And at Microsoft, it was typographic engineer because I wasn't a type designer. And I wasn't a software engineer. I was kind of in the middle.
Brilliant. We'll leave it there. Vincent Conair, thank you so much for talking to us today. Such short notice as well. That was absolutely fascinating.
Okay, thanks, James.
Now, as regular listeners will know, one topic we've covered a few times before is how and why kids should be taught computer programming. Now, whilst there are a lot of arguments for and against this, I think we should bring things back to basic. This week, Salim Fadli has been speaking to one of the men behind the BBC Micro. If you want this next report to be realistic, pause your audio player now for a few seconds to give it a chance to load.
30 years ago, a small British company called Acorn Computers launched the BBC Micro. This computer was nothing much by today's standards. It had 32 kilobytes of main memory and a 2 megahertz processor. In every way, this computer was thousands of times less capable than the phone in your pocket. And yet, without the team that built this odd-looking machine, you probably wouldn't have that phone. Because many of the inventions which are critical, many of the inventions which enable today's digital consumer technologies, are the legacy of the BBC Micro project and the team which originally built it. I'm joined by Steve Ferber, who is a professor of computer engineering at Manchester University. He was the co-inventor of the BBC Micro, and I began by asking how he became involved in this amazing project.
I've been involved with Acorn since its outset, when Herman and Chris founded it in the late 1970s. But I got interested in computers, joined the Cambridge University Processor Group, and got invited to contribute to the embryonic Acorn when it formed.
The BBC Micro was an astonishingly original vision. Acorn's BBC Micro really was something quite different.
Yes, well, the spec of the BBC Micro was ultimately determined through negotiations between Acorn and the BBC. What was unusual about it was the range of interfaces that it offered. The box was just riddled with connectors of various shapes and sizes and different levels of functionality. And that really was a result of quite a sophisticated spec that the BBC was looking for in terms of what could be connected to the machine on the outside.
It would be a real understatement to say that the BBC Micro had an impact on education. Just about every school in the UK had labs equipped with these machines. Just about every school began implementing courses in basic programming. It seems to me that these computers inspired a generation of developers, people like me who owe our career to your team's invention.
Its success exceeded everybody's expectations. They were confidently saying that on the back of the programs, Acorn should expect to sell about 12,000 of these machines. In the end, we shipped about 1.5 million BBC Micros and variants. So there was a huge appetite to take these machines on. The BBC Micro was the leader in the UK in education, and therefore, of course, attracted all the educational software developers. And so the whole thing snowballed. I still regularly meet people who say that the BBC Micro was the thing that set the direction for their subsequent career.
That certainly resonates with me. One of the most endearing things about the BBC Micro as a learning tool was that you simply had to just switch it on and it would be instantly ready to receive a program. So do you feel there's a need for something a bit more like the BBC Micro today, something which lets novice programmers be productive?
I certainly think that the displacement today of the BBC Micro, which after all is a machine designed for education, with conventional PCs, which are machines designed for offices, has put quite a high barrier between pupils using the machine and the interesting and creative sides of the machine itself. So I think there's a general recognition that today's PC has put the user too far away from the engine, and things need to change. We need somehow to find a way to get back in control and back into the creative seat in the machine.
The most common home computers these days are things like Xboxes or iPads, which are arguably even worse than the PC at keeping you far from the engine of computing. They're amazing machines, but they're completely closed to the average user. As computers are getting better, do you feel that our society might be becoming less computer literate?
I think there's quite a lot of concern about the general level of familiarity of users with technology today. And I would agree that machines such as the iPad, whilst amazingly useful, are virtually impossible for the average user to program to deliver results directly. On the other hand, there are other bits of technology which move the user much closer. So in the consumer domain, then the Lego Mindstorms offers a fairly directly accessible microcontroller with bits of mechanics and sensors. So you can get back closer to the machine, but it's in a different environment from the iPad or the PC. It's getting back down into microcontrollers and doing much lower level stuff in a much simpler environment, where I think people can find room to express their creativity with machines.
Of all your inventions, the BBC Micro is perhaps the one that had the most impact on my life. But as the original BBC products became obsolete, they were replaced with a new range of computers called the Acorn Archimedes. And even though these computers were never commercially successful of themselves, much of the technology that your team invented for this range of computers has had an enormous impact.
Yes. So following on from the success of the BBC Micro, and I think directly attributable to that success, was the development of the ARM processor at Acorn, which we developed for the Archimedes product originally. Archimedes was reasonably successful as far as the company was concerned, but never became anything big globally. But the ARM processor that we developed for it became of interest to Apple, who wanted to use it in their Newton, and they approached ARM to propose setting up a joint venture to develop the ARM. And of course, today, ARM is responsible for the processors in something like 98% of all mobile phones and in iPads and other tablets and many other digital products. The heritage of the BBC Micro, which is the ARM processor, is now the world's most successful microprocessor, and over 20 billion of them have been shipped in all manner of different products. I have a suspicion that ARM is responsible for more computing power on the planet than everybody else in the history of computing put together.
The BBC Micro, the project from which we've derived so much value, was a fairly modest government collaboration in order to improve computer literacy. It's clearly paid for itself many times over. Were we to do something like this today, the computer systems required could be built for a tiny fraction of the original price. It's not unreasonable to expect that investment in real computer literacy might continue to yield huge dividends. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, this next report's from Down Under, where it turns out that when Australians aren't tying kangaroos down, having a barbie, or imprisoning refugees in allegedly inhumane conditions, that there's a chance that they could be advocating some rather scary anti-vaccination opinions. Here's Andrew Gould to explain what on earth is going on. Again, for realism, do feel free to listen to this next report whilst upside down.
According to the World Health Organization, measles caused 164,000 deaths worldwide in 2008. That's 450 people dying every day. In 1980, before an effective vaccine was widely available, measles caused an estimated 2.6 million deaths. Whooping cough killed 195,000 children worldwide in 2008. The WHO estimates that global vaccination prevented 687,000 more. The number of cases of polio, a viral disease that leaves children crippled or unable to breathe, has decreased by over 99% since 1998 due to global vaccination. Now the virus only occurs in a few places in the world and is on the verge of being completely eradicated. Meningococcal meningitis, which most of us know only from a Tim Minchin song, can cause severe brain damage and is fatal in 50% of cases. In 2011, after a program of mass vaccination, several African countries reported the lowest number of infections ever. Smallpox was completely eradicated in 1979. Rinderpest in cattle was eradicated in 2010. We can combat these killers with vaccination. And yet, some people still think vaccines are a bad idea. Australia's most notorious anti-vaxxer is Merrill Dorey, president, I think, of the Australian Vaccination Network. Most Pod Delusion listeners should already be familiar with the AVN, but for those who aren't, here's a brief rundown. The Australian Vaccination Network claims to be a consumer advocacy and pro-choice group that provides parents with information about vaccination in order to help them make an informed choice about whether to vaccinate their children. In July 2010, the New South Wales Government Health Care Complaints Commission, the HCCC, issued a public warning over the Australian Vaccination Network. The Commission's investigation revealed that the AVN's website provides information that is solely anti-vaccination, contains information that is incorrect and misleading, and quotes selectively from research to suggest that vaccination may be dangerous. The Commission instructed the AVN to include a prominent statement on their website stating that the AVN's purpose is to provide information against vaccination, that the information provided by the AVN should not be read as medical advice, and that the decision about whether or not to vaccinate should be made in consultation with a healthcare provider. The public warning also states that failure to include such a notice poses a risk to public health and safety. The Australian Vaccination Network, in turn, gave the HCCC the middle finger. In December 2010, the New South Wales Office of Liquor, Gaming and Racing revoked the AVN's charitable fundraising authority, finding that they had breached fundraising laws and potentially misled the public. Again, this appears to have had little effect on the AVN's operations. I'm sure I don't need to quote more statistics about the impact that the anti-vaccination movement has had on global vaccination rates, or cite outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases in areas of the developed world that really should know better. But what does all this have to do with a music festival? The Woodford Folk Festival is an annual music festival held near the small country town of Woodford, 72 kilometres north of Brisbane in Queensland. It's one of the biggest annual cultural events of its type in Australia, with some 130,000 patrons attending annually, many of whom camp for the full 6 days until the New Year's Day fire spectacular. Past performers have included the Cat Empire, James Morrison, Kate Miller-Heidke, Tripod, and the John Butler Trio. This year, the lineup also includes Merrill Dorey. Merrill has been invited, as she has been once before, to give two talks at the festival. As you would expect, sceptical activists have mobilised, writing to the organisers and sponsors of the folk festival, and the story has been picked up by the mainstream media, with articles on the Brisbane Courier-Mail, the Brisbane Times, the Sunshine Coast Daily, and on the ABC, Australia's national broadcaster. And of course, it's been all over the blogosphere. Reasonable Hank, Skeptimite, Token Skeptic, Drunken Madman, and all the way up to the rarefied heights of Feringula, all expressing opposition to Dory's talk. Merrill has, of course, cited that this is an attack on her right to free speech. She certainly has the right to hold her own opinions. But opinions do not equal facts. It is a fact that vaccines save lives. It is a fact that the AVN's website contains misleading information. Dory does not have the right to put children at risk by misleading frightened and vulnerable parents into allowing their children to be subjected to diseases that can kill, when those diseases can be prevented, for little risk, by widespread vaccination. And she does not have the right to a state-funded platform from which to spread such misleading information. It looks like there's no chance of getting Dory off the bill for this year's festival. The festival's executive director, Bill Horitz, has stated that Dory has a right to her opinion, that they've already entered into contracts, and that the damage is already done. He also committed the argument at Google fallacy when he said that he typed doctors against vaccinations into Google and got pages and pages and pages of results. Actually, he's right on that one. Doctors Against Vaccinations gets 143,000 hits on Google. What he probably doesn't know is that Doctors for Vaccinations gets 833,000 hits. So Merrill's go to speak. Okay, let a voice be heard. Fortunately, this year, you'll also hear the voices of proponents of science and evidence-based medicine providing balance to Dory's anti-vaccination message and helping parents to make an informed choice about whether to vaccinate their children. I wonder where I've heard that before. Oh, and as I was preparing to record this piece, news came from the Queensland Health Minister, the Honourable Geoff Wilson. His press release states, quote, "I love Woodford Folk Festival. I've been numerous times. There's great music, great food and great folk entertainment. Fortunately, there's enough wonderful things to do at Woodford that patrons have plenty of alternatives rather than sitting through the nonsense Merrill Dory spouts about vaccination dangers. For the small number of people who might be entertained by what Ms. Dory has to say, Woodford Folk Festival has a place for everyone. Just don't take her nonsense too seriously." The full press release can be found at www.cabinet.qld.gov.au. Clearly, this is a fast-moving issue. If you want to stay up to date, go over to wiki.mycolleaguesareidiots.com/doryatwoodford.ashx. Jason Brown is keeping a log of articles, news reports and blog posts about the issue. This is Andrew Gould, juicing the piglet for the Pod Delusion.
Now there's a new book out that's based on an iPad app. That's right, it's not the other way around, it's based on an iPad app. It's a bit odd, but I quite like the idea of taking modern media and turning it into a book. I'd love to read a novelisation of the Lord of the Rings films, for instance. I reckon they were at least long enough to fill out an entire book. Here's Liz Luckendorf with more.
A few weeks ago, we had an interview with author, science communicator, and genuinely nice guy Marcus Chan about his new book with Hovert Schilling called Tweeting the Universe. In that interview, we talked a little bit about his solar system app for iPad and now published book. Since I can't resist books, especially shiny, shiny science books, Marcus and I had a follow-up chat about the most bonkers things in the solar system. Since my astronomy knowledge is about a decade out of date, I was genuinely fascinated by all the facts and the photos that we've taken over the years. So what is strange, marvelous, and bonkers about the solar system? Well, the more I read, the more I thought everything was bonkers. But here's Marcus talking about how we make sense of it.
That's why we send space probes to the around the solar system. You know, I mean, nature has been incredibly kind to us because it's not only given us Earth, but it's given us other versions of Earth. So, it's as if we can twiddle a knob. We're gods and we can twiddle a knob and say, well, what would it be like if Earth was 10 times more massive? What would it be like if it was 10 times closer to the sun? And we can look around the solar system and we can see all these examples. So they tell us things about the Earth as well. For instance, we discovered about the greenhouse effect by looking at Venus. You know, the Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect. It's closer to the sun. Its oceans have boiled away. It has an atmosphere of carbon dioxide. And it means that its surface is hot enough to melt lead. It has sulfuric acid clouds. It's hell. Venus is hell. But Venus is what it's like if you heat up the Earth slightly. You get Venus. Then when we went to Mars, the first probes, like Mariner 9, went to Mars, and the people who, the engineers were and astronomers, were incredibly disappointed, because when it arrived, Mars was covered in a planet-wide dust storm, and they couldn't see anything at all. And this dust storm massively cooled the planet, and of course, the people who worked on Mariner, like Carl Sagan, then went on to develop ideas of nuclear winter and say, well, God, you know, if we have a global nuclear war, we'll put a lot of material, a lot of dust into the atmosphere, reflect sunlight, it'll be just like Mars.
One of the things that seems very unlike to appear in the natural world is the poles of Saturn, or one of the poles of Saturn, which is a hexagon. Which I found, why is there a hexagon pole on Saturn?
The short answer is nobody knows. But of course, the reason why we send space probes is to find new things. If we knew everything, there'd be no point in doing it, you know. But yes, you're absolutely right. At the North Pole of Saturn is a hurricane, the shape of a hexagon. And we know it's very persistent. The pictures that we've got at the moment were taken by Cassini, which is a space probe currently in orbit around Saturn. I think it's been in orbit since 2006. But we know from the Voyager space probes that went past Saturn, or at least one of them went past Saturn, I believe, 25 years ago, that the hexagon existed there. So this is an incredibly stable meteorological phenomenon. What causes it? Well, that's a real mystery. If you take a fluid and you spin it in a bucket, you do get these kind of structures. They're called standing waves. Basically, the fluid or liquid, maybe it's water, bounces off the boundary of the bucket, and you get these waves, which can be square, they can be triangular, they can be hexagonal. So that's very, very suggestive. However, there doesn't appear to be any container in the atmosphere of Saturn.
A lot of the pictures that you have are either from Cassini or Voyager and things like that. And it's just amazing the amount of variety you get in the universe. And the moons and the Oort cloud objects are another fascinating thing. So Hyperion, I think it was, the moon that orbits faster and then slower and then reverses. Do we know how that happened?
Well, it turns out that Hyperion is a moon of Saturn, but it's kind of pulled by Saturn. It's also pulled by Titan. So it's kind of like being tugged in many different directions. And this causes it to move in a chaotic way, you know, unpredictable way. So as you say, it will tumble, and then it will slow its tumbling, and then it will speed up its tumbling. It's an example of what we call chaos. And in fact, it's the first example of chaotic motion ever observed in the solar system. It was actually predicted by, I think it was a man called Jacques Lascaris. So, yeah, it's a fascinating moon. But, you know, you think to yourself that the planets and moons would are the epitome of regularity. I mean, we talk about, ever since Newton, we talk about the clockwork of the solar system, of Newtonian clockwork. But then you see, although the planets and moons appear to orbit regularly, there is the possibility of completely unpredictable motion.
How much do you think we can still find out about the solar system with probes, and how much do you think our view of the solar system has yet to change?
Well, I think our picture of the solar system can yet change dramatically. I mean, there is currently a probe, MESSENGER, which has gone to Mercury. Now, incredibly, Mercury, the nearest planet to the Sun, is the most unstudied. And really, if you think of all the probes that have been to Mars, and I think we've sent scores of probes to Mars, about half of which have actually not made it, or they've crashed or something like that. They've only landed in you know, certain locations, you know. I mean, it would be like landing a space probe and you happen to land it in the middle of the Sahara Desert and trying to infer what the Earth was like from that, you know. So I think we shouldn't kid ourselves that most of the surface area of the planets and moons of our solar system, the overwhelming majority, is totally unexplored. Enceladus, I mean, that's got to be one of the biggest surprises. We think that we would only get liquid water on a body that is close enough to the Sun for ice to melt. But actually, it turns out that's not true, because some bodies, for instance, Europa, which is an ice giant ice moon of Jupiter, are being stretched and squeezed by the gravity of Jupiter. So if you squeeze a squash ball repeatedly, it gets hot. So they're actually being heated by what we call tidal heating. We think there's a giant ocean underneath the ice of Europa. But we are now finding that even tiny bodies like Enceladus, which is a moon of Saturn, tidal forces are creating water inside them. This is a body much smaller than anywhere we would expect to find water. But we've seen these ice fountains. So again, you know, and that was an amazing surprise. And it completely changes our picture of where we would find life. We don't know what the ingredients for life are because we've only got one example, but we think that water might be essential. And now we're finding that water can exist inside tiny bodies on the frozen outskirts of the solar systems.
There was a probe smashed into the moon with the ashes of a scientist named Shoemaker. I find that fascinating. Is there anyone else who's been kind of immortalized in a probe being smashed into something?
As far as I know, no. No, but the interesting thing is, yes, you're absolutely right, Gene Shoemaker is the only person buried on the moon. Now, most people don't seem to understand that or realise that. Gene Shoemaker was a famous geologist. He famously showed that the craters on the moon were created by impacts of bodies. Remember, there was a huge argument, which we forget. You know, were the craters on the moon volcanic, or were they actually created by impacts? And he was the first person who showed that. He also agitated. He was involved in the training of the astronauts for Apollo, and he agitated over a long period of time to get a scientist to go to the moon. And finally, he achieved his ambition on the very last Apollo mission, Apollo 17. Yeah, there was a probe called Clementine that went to the moon, I think in about 10 years ago, to map the moon from orbit. And at the time, Shoemaker had died, and the scientist who works on Clementine said, why don't we put Gene Shoemaker's ashes on this space probe, which is going to crash into the moon. And his family were really happy about this. So actually, Gene Shoemaker is the only person buried on the moon.
Since we just ended up chatting for about 25 minutes about the solar system, there is, of course, the longer interview on the Pod Delusion website. If you are looking for a last-minute present for the astronomy geek in your life, the Solar System book by Marcus Chan is beyond pretty. While you can't twirl Jupiter with your finger like you can do on the iPad, which is amazingly cool, I must say, it still contains some of the best astronomy photos that probes like Cassini and Voyager have collected in the last 30 years. This has been Liz Lusendorf with the very lovely Marcus Chan for the Pod Delusion.
Now, is Sesame Street pushing socialism onto unsuspecting Americans? I guess it sort of makes sense. After all, what is the Cookie Monster if not a transparent allegory for consumer capitalism? In fact, I've written to the people who make Sesame Street and suggested a new character, a sort of cat-like character called Galloway, who could teach all the other characters about modesty by, over the course of an episode, discovering his own. Well, it's an idea anyway. Here's Tom Hodden with more.
Did you used to watch Sesame Street when you were younger? Brilliant, wasn't it? Did you like the bit where they taught you to count and about different words and letters? How about when it told you to become dependent on government handouts and demand free food at the expense of which your taxpayers? Surreal as that may sound, a right-wing news, and I use that term loosely, site on the internet called CNS News, has been outraged by the Sesame Street Food for Thought campaign. The headline is Muppets Pitch Government Dependence Free Food at School Campaign. Right, the Food for Thought campaign is aimed at parents of children between 2 and 8 years old who have limited or uncertain access to healthy food. In these hard economic times, this is an increasing range. Much of the material is fair to encourage kids to try new foods, branching out into healthier choices than what you might call junk food. Materials are available from the webpage like New Foods Are Fun, Let's Eat Together, and Healthy Snacks, all featuring the lovable Henson creations. What has CNS, who described themselves without irony as the right news right now, in a fury, is one of the videos in which Lily Muppet at the National Press Club talks about the resources available to those who need them. She mentions that as part of a meal plan, she has a free breakfast at school and sometimes a lunch. That's right, she's telling parents what help is available if they can't afford food for their children. This is apparently shocking that a campaign to encourage a balanced and healthy lifestyle might go so far as to tell needy parents where they might find help from services that are already available. This is somewhat different from pitching the idea, as the headline stated. The report seems to complain that a spokeswoman for the WIC, Women, Infants and Children's section of the Food Nutrition Service, did not elaborate when stating the project could be seen as a deficit reduction strategy. Now, I struggle to see how any of this deserves a negative headline. Are we to believe that people will purposefully choose to be poor and claim benefits because the Muppets make it look cool? or that the campaign will encourage young people to become dependent on the state and not want to be able to afford to feed themselves. Perhaps I'm looking at this the wrong way, but at what point did helping a two-year-old to be able to eat properly become a bad thing? I'm not going to talk about some of the people who left comments on the story. They are just opinionated members of the public, like myself, who have no journalistic responsibility. What raises my heckles is when a campaign to make people aware of the resources their own government makes available for the needy is characterised, without reason, as having encouraged people to become dependent on those resources. Decades ago, Robert Kennedy pointed out the reason that some of the poorest families in his country had obese children was because they were forced to buy the poor quality unhealthy junk food they could afford instead of the food they needed, if they could afford food at all. You can be as angry and despairing about it as you want, and let people worry about who is supposed to pay for all this, but let me remind you, this is a campaign about 2 to 8 year old children. Exactly what breed of moustache-twirling villain must you be if you are willing to put a negative slant on a campaign to ensure that 2 to 8 year old children are healthy? I, being the optimist that I am, would like to think this is indeed a deficit reduction scheme on a long time scale. Encouraging kids to be healthy, grow healthy now, and you'll be burdened with fewer sick people draining resources when they're older. Help them now, and they may stand a chance of ensuring they can afford food for their own kids in the decades to come. Helping families to plan better meals and offer a healthier lifestyle to children, even when times are hard, cannot be a bad thing, surely. This has been Tom Hodden for The Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, we have a double bill of reports from some big science-themed theatre shows that have been taking place in London. I know what you're thinking. With all of those scientists going into showbiz, how is Britain going to retain its leading reputation for research if no one is actually in the lab doing some science? Well, I think we'll be okay, because inevitably, with all these scientists going onto the stage, we're going to see celebrities forced out and forced to choose alternative career paths. So I'm looking forward to hearing what Vernon Kay thinks about the Higgs. I'm finding out the results of the experiment to find out just how Nick Knowles keeps getting work. We start, though, with the Festival of the Spoken Nerd. Matt Parker, Steve Mould and Helen Arney hold monthly science nights on different topics, writing new material each time. They've just announced their biggest show yet at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London, so we caught up with them to find out what on earth is going to be going on.
Festival of the Spoken Nerd is a celebration of nerdiness, science, comedy. It's a live show. It's monthly. It's in London.
That's one way of looking at
and
it.
And that's full marks to Steve.
Yeah. The other thing that Festival of the Spoken Nerd is myself, Helen Arney, Steve Mould, who you just heard, and Matt Parker.
Howdy.
It's the three of us who do Festival of the Spoken Nerd. So every month, we do a show in London. We sometimes do science festivals, we do extra shows. We pick a theme every month, and we get to just play around with that and do our own things.
It's an excuse, really. It's an excuse to be nerdy live on stage. Yeah. There are very few normal comedy audiences who want to hear your new material on prime numbers.
There is some killer Gauss stuff.
My Fourier transform stuff. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. No one would go with me on it. So,
I've written another Gauss joke for tonight.
You've written another Gauss joke?
I'm not going to tell you. You get it later.
Have you rhymed it with ass?
No.
So it's more sophisticated than my one, then.
My second question was going to be, like, how did you get from doing all these different things to going, let's do this festival?
It was the Edinburgh Fringe, wasn't it? Because we were all there doing nerdy shows.
Yeah.
Matt was doing Your Days Are Numbered,
The Maths of Death, yeah.
You were doing Mould and Aerosmith, massively nerdy.
In 3D.
That's
a good number of Ds.
Really good
number
of Ds.
Yes, we had 3D glasses in the audience, and 3D. We had 3D projectors on the screen.
That's and right. You yourselves were three-dimensional.
And we were, of course, three-dimensional. That is the nature of live theatre.
And I was doing a solo comedy show that was turned out to be quite nerdy. And we realised a lot of people were going to all our three shows and telling... I had people telling me about you, and I'm like, yeah, I know.
I know the guy.
I know.
You'd be handing out flyers when you leave the show, come to think of it.
He's on my list of shows to see. Like, he's on my list of shows to tell other people to see. And we were going to do something at the Fringe, and we never got around to it because of Fringe madness. But didn't we find the text that you sent us?
Yeah, we actually...
This is really sweet. This is like a romance story.
We actually got a little text where I text both these guys, a group text saying, hey, we should totally do a do a group show just messing around at the and Helen can sing over it at the end of the Fringe.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do the Steve Wright in the afternoon thing.
Oh,
like, you know, with the romantic music.
You mentioned that you do a new one every month.
Mm.
How difficult is that? Because I know most people, most comedians have a show that they tour for a very long time and that seems very, very hard on yourselves.
It, it well, is kind of the point, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not polished. That's one way to make it easier.
it's easy to write. It's just making it good to the tricky bit.
Yeah. Relying heavily on Wikipedia and Google image search is another way of reducing
crowdsourcing through Twitter.
Crowdsourcing through Twitter is good. I think we've got better at turning ideas that we think of a few weeks before into something workable for the show. And also, it's the audience that we get as well. They go to... I've seen them at a lot of different other science events, and often they will see the same people do the same thing, which is wonderful. And we do it as well.
The stuff that works, works. Yeah.
I'm doing the Uncaged Monkeys tour at the moment with Brian Cox and Robin Ince. I do the same thing every night. It's like that's... You know, that's what I know works for that. But the whole point of the audience we get is that they want to see a new show every month. They don't want to see the same thing again.
They want to see stuff go wrong.
They really want to see stuff go wrong. And actually, that's really part of it.
We deliver.
That's a real deliverable that we can achieve.
and it's kind of a self-fulfilling cycle as well, because we'll meet and discuss ideas for new shows and we'll have, I've got a bit of a proto idea.
Yeah.
Can we try and make a show where we can use this, and then it kind of rolls from there.
Some things work, some things don't. Which is why in January we're doing
to preempt the next question.
We're doing a kind of, I suppose it's a best of. We've been doing these shows for a year now. We started in a 40-seater room above a pub. We're now in the 120-seat New Red Line where we are today. We're doing the ludicrously large 530-seat Bloomsbury.
535
seats. Yeah. So we've taken the whole year's worth of shows that we've done, and we are picking out our favourite bits to do that we've done a few times now. We haven't just done them once, and turning it into a kind of best of, two thirds, best of a third. We are doing some new stuff.
Yeah,
definitely.
Mm. We want it to feel like a nice, consistent night where the three of us work together as a team. Yeah. And even though obviously we all have our individual strengths and weaknesses, it's a team.
Definitely. We spend most of the time on stage together.
My strength's graphs, by the way.
Matt's strength is graphs.
My weakness is not knowing when to not use a graph.
that's an absolute joy, getting to spend pretty much the whole show on stage together and becoming part of each other's stuff. And it's so much fun to do. Like, we always do an experiment with the audience.
Well,
that always happens.
What sort of experiments do you do? That sounds intriguing and terrifying.
We're doing game theory stuff tonight.
Yeah.
We've got a game theory approach to see how people respond as an audience and how people work together as a group, because there's one very clear thing they could do that would benefit all of them. But there's individual gain for not helping everyone else.
It's kind of like Prisoner's Dilemma.
It's Prisoner's Dilemma
massive
for
scale.
Do you all
work together and share a little bit of...
Or is one person going to be a jerk?
And possibly ruin it for everyone and even ruin it for themselves?
The answer is yes.
Yes.
We did this last night and there was one absolute
He was a massive jerk.
She was
a jerk by default.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tighten up the rules tonight.
All right, okay.
She got a bit meta on
her. You have to listen to the podcast to find out our podcast. We've got a podcast.
We'll see what happens this evening.
A lot of the, and especially your show, but, Robin Ince, Brian Cox and these type shows, they're very sciencey. Do you think the same kind of nerdery would apply to, you know, art and history? Could you have a festival of the spoken art nerd, as it were?
Well, today we're doing a show about money. So
it's kind of finance, history.
That's practically arts.
Yeah.
I think like history, definitely you could
there
get.
There are definitely
art,
history
I don't
nerds.
Know, probably.
There are.
Music, must, I mean, music.
The nerds, it's a full menagerie of different types of nerds. You'd be amazed what people can become a little obsessed about.
Yeah, I guess we focus on the science thing, because that's the thing we find like has the richest...
nerdy
source
culture
and maths and
we're kind of like polynerds where we're all nerdy about a very wide range of things so I'm obviously nerdy about graphs and numbers and maths, but I also love programming and engineering and game theory stuff and so
you just said that was that basically translates to I'm nerdy about maths but also maths and maths.
There were nuances in what I was saying.
You can find links to buy tickets to their January Bloomsbury show on our website at poddelusion.co.uk, including a special discount code that will get you money off tickets if you order by the end of December. Now, on a similar note, the Pod Delusion's own Dean Bernettis has been a busy man indeed. If you're going to Robin Ince's Godless Christmas show on Sunday the 18th of December, then you'll see Dean on stage doing some standing up. But he's also been putting on shows of his own, and last Monday he made the trek from Cardiff to London to put on a science cabaret night. If that wasn't enough work, he took some time out to record all the backstage gossip for us so we could catch up with what has been happening. Here's Dean, with more.
On Monday the 12th of December, 2011, if you listen to this at some future point, in London, the city of London, that's the capital city of Britain, if you're not familiar with it, there were several cabaret nights going on, actually, several science-based entertainment events, one of which was at the Institution of Engineering and Technology, where myself and several of my colleagues from Cardiff were asked to come and do a science cabaret night. We'd done it once in Cardiff, it worked quite well. They asked us to come and do it in the capital city as a sort of Christmas cabaret celebration type thing. I don't really know what the correct term for it is, but it definitely happened and there were people there. So what follows are a few interviews and some background gossip from the night itself. To give you a glimpse of what happens at a science communication type event, which doesn't involve famous people which you've already heard of. All right, so I'm here with Rhys Phillips, who essentially organised this night, but also is a speaker. Rhys, hello.
Did you say potentially organised this night?
No, essentially organised this night.
Oh, essentially organised.
I think it was just you, but I'm assuming like the quantum wavelength has collapsed now. We are actually here and doing this.
I think so.
Yeah, we think so. You're into this ambiguity now. I was going to say you're an expert on lightning, but it's more specific than that, isn't it? You're an expert on how lightning affects planes, per se.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say the word expert. I mean, it.
It's
a fairly niche market, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. I would say, as far as I know, you're an expert. I don't know anyone who knows more than you, so from my own personal perspective, you're an expert on lightning, how it affects planes.
Within the group of people here tonight, I probably am.
Right, good. Do you want to give a little brief summary of what you do? What is your role, and what is your...
I work within a research team, but in industry, not in academia. And we're looking at how to protect the next generation of composite aircraft against lightning strikes. So metal aircraft are safe because you get a Faraday cage effect. The current from the lightning bolt can travel around the plane and everyone's perfectly safe. Composite, which we're now using composite materials to make them lighter, that of course means that it can't dissipate the current as well. And so we've got to find a way of preventing damage.
Good. For those who don't know, Rhys said he's industry not academic. It's pretty much exactly the same thing, but he gets paid more and gets to go home on weekends. That is essentially what you do. Now, I've also got to ask you this, but I haven't done it until this interview, because I thought it might be funny.
Oh, dear.
The budget airlines, I mean, is there a difference between your mainstream airlines and your budget airlines to the extent they protect against lightning like this sort of thing? Or is it a legal requirement?
It is a legal requirement, but I think that Ryanair charge extra if you want to get hit less amount of times by lightning bolts.
Well, if they can control lightning, then I guess we better hand agree with what they want to do, because that is quite a powerful thing.
No, it's a legal requirement. There are standards that we have to meet both in America and in Europe, so Airbus and Boeing have the same standards they have to build aircraft to, no matter what airline buys them.
You can reassure them.
That's one thing they can't get away with skimping on.
Good. But are there certain levels of protection that a plane go through, or is it like the baseline of all or nothing? It's like a binary thing.
No, it's we protect build the planes to be protected against worst case scenarios. So we model and test to the over and above what we'd realistically expect in terms of intensity of lightning strike to actually hit a plane. And it's rigorous testing takes place in laboratories where you take parts of planes and even whole planes in some cases and check a load of electrical current in the same waveform that you'd have as a lightning bolt, and make sure that it lives up to what it's meant to.
That's cool. Actually,
hot, actually. It's 30,000 degrees Celsius.
I hear someone that a typical lightning bolt is something like four times the surface of the sun temperature. Is that?
I think it might be more, actually. It's 30,000 degrees Celsius. I should be clear, that is the surface of the sun that it's hotter than, not the centre of the sun. Some people disbelieve that, but it is the surface of the sun we're talking about.
Also, I didn't want to actually... when I did physics, they explained about lightning, how it sort of works, or like the grounding effect, and as I said, there's different sort of lightning.
The energy for lightning, it's always meant to be quite a high energy thing, but not a voltage thing. But they were, last time I checked, this is A-level physics, so it was quite a while ago, that they didn't know where the energy for lightning comes from specifically. They mentioned sort of friction and size particles.
Well, we know where the energy comes from. It's a separation of charge in the cloud.
Yeah.
What we don't understand fully is why the charge separates in the first place. It's most likely due to heating and cooling effects, some particles rising up as they heat up, and then others cooling and coming back down. Water and ice particles melting and freezing, and all of this builds up charge, and you then tend to get positive charge at the top of the cloud, negative at the bottom, and the more charge separation you get, the more it wants to jump. A bit like when you approach a door handle sometimes, or a car, you get a static shock off it, because you've built up a charge in your body, and it wants to neutralise, and as soon as you get close to that metal object,
that's
it can,
the earth
it can
thing,
jump.
Is that the earth thing, or?
Well, it doesn't actually have to be, but it is, but not directly. A lot of people think that cars are protected because of the tyres on them, but realistically, if charge built up on a car to the extent it does with lightning, it would jump down to the ground regardless of the tyres.
Power
so
stuff, yeah.
It is earth, which is why it jumps all the way down to the ground from the cloud.
Yeah, but essentially it takes a run-up. It's got the energy to do that. That's always good.
Yeah.
Well, cool. I think the most important question that people like me would want to ask is, in the right circumstances, could lightning feasibly reanimate a corpse?
have you not read the Mary Shelley classic?
Well, that's again, it was a fiction-based thing, but it's maybe she's like Arthur C. Clarke. I mean, she could predict things coming. I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, you know, we have this. Lightning starts off at clouds, goes down to the ground, we call that cloud-to-ground lightning, and the other way around, we funnily enough call it ground-to-cloud lightning.
You guys are so imaginative.
I know, it takes us ages to think of these names. Around sort of the end of October each year, we do sometimes get this cloud-to-corpse lightning, it does happen.
The weird thing is, because you're obviously an expert in lightning, as we've specified, and unequivocally you are an expert in lightning. But also, I have access to brains and corpses. We could test this.
Together, we could do all sorts of...
Between us, we could be a Frankenstein. Bagsy Stein.
You can hear a full version of Dean's report on the Pod Delusion website at poddelusion.co.uk. And that's it for this week's show. Remember to check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can support Liz and support the Pod Delusion. Please do, if you enjoy this show, make a one-off donation or subscribe and support us every month. It would be really appreciated, especially during this challenging time. Also on our website, you can listen to extended versions of many of the interviews on this week's show, like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and all that sort of thing. You can also find over 2 years' worth of Pod Delusion archives, which is full of loads of good stuff. That's all at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, Salim Fadley, Andrew Gould, Liz Luckendorf, Tom Hodden, Dean Burnett, and me, James O'Malley, with much, much additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Erect majesty of the lodgepole pines here in Wyoming, belittling all mankind with its effortless grandeur. And here, not 30 feet from where I'm standing, we see 500 pounds of Ursus actus horribilis, more commonly known as the brown bear.
Okay, you can stop there, David love. We've got the footage of the bear foraging, we can add in there.
What? But the bear is right there. We can just film it foraging in front of us.
Don't worry, Dave. We got a 30-second clip of a foraging bear. He's much more photogenic than the moth-eaten thing you've been tracking all day. And his agent isn't demanding repeat fees.
This is ridiculous. I covered for you on the frozen planet polar bear debacle, but that doesn't give you carte blanche to intersperse my work with fake video.
It's fine, David. Come on, we were making movies.
That's exactly what I said. And we only just got away with it.
Look, here's the footage we're going to use.
Let me see. Well, he is a better looking bear. He's got the right movement.
See? No trouble.
But we're never going to get away with this one. Look, he looks completely different.
What do you mean? He's brown, he's fat, he's got four paws.
And a green hat and a matching tie. This is not a circus.
Well, the light's all wrong now. We're going to have to use the video we've got.
That's it. I've had enough. It's cold. It's miserable. And to cap it all off, someone's stolen my picnic basket.
Way! Run, Boo Boo! Looks like we've been rumbled!